This is CliffCentral.com.
Very excited to introduce to you two ladies, India Martin and Camille John Jenkins. They're both businesswomen who are in the country at the moment for the Leadership for Life Centenary Delegation Business Summit, which was held on Monday the 16th of July, and they are visiting South Africa from the United States. The summit's actually a curated delegation of American executives who are visiting during the week of Madiba's 100th birthday celebration to share thoughts on leadership and build business relationships. They're both actually off to visit the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls after this interview, so Sia is excited for them. It's the only reason he stays in South Africa.
I'd already offered. I told them my schedule is free after 9 a.m. I can open doors, I can carry bags, and I'll sing the Oprah Winfrey Show's theme song as well.
You understand the show and the Leadership Academy are two different things, right?
Yeah, no, it still has Oprah in it. That's all that matters.
As long as it has Oprah in
Mama
it.
Mama Oprah.
Damn right. And who doesn't love her? And everywhere she goes, she seems to make a very positive difference. I assume that is why you ladies are here, to make a positive difference too.
Absolutely. Yes. So thank you for having us.
What an absolute pleasure. So let me introduce you properly. India is a 25-year veteran of financial services, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council. She's held a number of global C-suite roles, including expatriate assignments in London, Frankfurt, Tokyo, Hong Kong. Wow, you've been around the world.
Yeah, right.
And she was at J.P. Morgan, where she was managing director and global chief operating officer for investment banking technology and operations. I mean, you must have had a card this long.
It was very long. I often abbreviated, but everyone said, no acronyms, please. Wow. So, you know, that's just happened that way.
You're also a globally recognized leadership expert and coach with a clientele of Fortune 500 and C-suite executives from around the world. It sounds to me like you might have a really interesting contact list on your phone.
Maybe just a little.
Mm-hmm.
I might share it with you if you're really nice to me.
I'm going to do my best.
Confidentiality is number one in my book.
So first of all, India, because I want to get to talking about Camille in a second, sure. But you've been in the country for a couple of days now. How did the leadership summit on Monday go?
Oh, it was fantastic. So I do a lot of work across the continent in South Africa. It's one of the places that I come quite frequently and love to come. So for me,
not your first rodeo.
No, it's not my first rodeo. I had my first team here when I was working at Deutsche Bank, actually, in 1999. So that was my first rodeo in South Africa. So I've been around for a while.
You've been in South Africa as long as Sia. He's only born in 1999.
Bless your heart, Sia. Bless you. So no, it's not my first rodeo. But the summit, you asked about the summit specifically, and that. It was wonderful. We had some really, really great folks there. So Colin Coleman keynoted from Goldman Sachs, and Kuseni Dlamini, who's the chairman of MassMart and chairman of Aspen Pharmacare, was on one of the panels that I moderated. We had a great cadre of South African business leaders, in addition to the delegation that we brought from the States. So it was really fantastic. And I think the thing that I loved the most was the transparency between both groups of people, and that being that, you know, there are problems all over the world. So for everything you can say you have as a challenge in South Africa, we can certainly point to that in America. I think that it's hard.
We often feel like we're behind the curve.
Absolutely.
And we're not dealing with the same first world problems that America is. But really, the problems
are... Do you watch our news?
The problems are universal. Well, we were in your news for the last 2 days because your former president was talking about your current president in much more subtle terms than I just have. Very good. Very diplomatic about it. But Camille, it's a pleasure to have you here, too. Let me just tell everybody a little bit about you. You're Senior Vice President for Business Strategy, Global Commercial Banking at the Bank of America in Washington, but you're actually here in your personal capacity.
I am.
Because you've been a global business strategist within commercial banking for a long time all over the world. So the two of you, did you know each other before you came here?
Yes, we did.
I would have
imagined. Carefully curated delegation.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you're both in similar areas, right?
Yeah.
You must have had some interactions in the States, and because you're both interested in the world, you would have met up there as well.
Certainly.
You're also an expert at teaching financial literacy to underrepresented populations, and you use a mechanism called Better Money Habits. We know in this country that's something we've got to do a lot of work in. We've got a huge percentage of our population who are unbanked.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a massive number of people who are commercially very savvy. There's a lot of street smart. But when it comes to the opportunities that leveraging your finances better can do, that owning things, that having the ability to move money around much more easily, these can have tremendously positive effects for people who are even earning very, very small amounts of money, right?
Exactly. It's actually expensive to be poor, believe it or not. Yeah. And we've seen so many individuals who, by not managing their money, they end up having to go to payday lenders, check cashing places, and the fees for that, as well as the process, can be extremely challenging. What I like about Better Money Habits is it makes everything a bit clearer, at least in providing definition, providing strategy, and it allows you to start having a conversation about what makes sense for that individual. And I wanted to plug Better Money Habits, because it's a partnership with Khan Academy that Bank of America has. So it's part of our framework. It's part of our culture to make sure we're going out and sharing that in the community, either through schools, through non-governmental organizations. So we're getting the word out.
I think there are a lot of people who don't trust the structures all over the world at the moment, right? And banks are part of the structure to most people. Mm-hmm. So is this just cynicism because politicians have been lying to us for years and years and years? Is it because the banking crisis of 2008 made people in certainly the first world very suspicious of exactly how things happen behind the scenes? Or is it also just a genuine self-reliance for many people, whether they're rich or poor, that they prefer to put their money under the mattress and they know it's there, than to take it to a bank where you could lose it? You could be defrauded. There's identity theft these days. There are big stories that we hear in the news about how whole countries sink billions, if not trillions, into projects that seem to only keep the bankers in business mm-hmm. and put them out.
Mm-hmm. I would say D, all of the above. So, you know, you have challenges, and you got to look at the background. And speaking from an American perspective, and I'm sure here, my family is from Trinidad and Tobago. So when you came, it was hard to get credit. You didn't have established relationships here. So you started with what we call susus, where you would share money mm-hmm. and you know, kind of build pots of money with family. So it's really sometimes your perspective and where you came from.
We have Stockfels in South Africa. Mm.
Okay, Stockfels, similar. Yeah. Okay. So just thinking about what your money blueprint is or your DNA, that's what starts the conversation. And then absolutely, there's a lack of trust, and rightfully so. If every other headline shows that, you know, we've been dealing with redlining, which means that certain groups were kept out of certain areas by not providing lending to them. Mm-hmm. So you're pushing them in certain neighborhoods, not being able to get banking done. I can understand why people still feel very uncomfortable with putting their money into banks, and absolutely. They're looking for other ways to make it work, to make their money work for them.
How do we persuade people who aren't banked to start doing it? Because obviously when you become part of the formal economy, you absolutely. Open up a universe of possibilities mm-hmm. to yourself, absolutely. Which you don't have if you only work in cash or if you're only part of a rural, very local economy. How do we persuade people this is a good idea when they are so suspicious?
Go ahead, you take that.
Well, I'll jump in there. I think we have to show, and I think mobile banking is going to become very huge as we see emerging economies continue to mature, so that people can see the power of being able to move money just through their phone. I mean, mm-hmm. we have things like even the Cash App. I can send you money without even establishing an account. That will, I think, start to get people comfortable with the movement without having to engage in a huge way with a bank account. You're not going to be able to we're moving more to a cashless society.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have to participate in some way for you to
grow.
Isn't
it weird how people, I mean, I know some very sophisticated people who are still nervous to use their credit cards to buy things mm-hmm. online.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is in a world where this is now ubiquitous. It's easy to do. You could order something and deliver it wherever you are mm-hmm. in 3 days' time. Mm-hmm. And it happens. We know this. There's good reason to trust in these systems. Amazon's the biggest company in the world,
absolutely.
According to some people now, and I see Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world again. This is not by chance. Mm-hmm. He's got the marketplace, mm-hmm. and he's got the means to connect to his marketplace like no one has ever had in human history. Mm-hmm. So why is it that in Africa, where we have such massive problems around the connection between people and mm-hmm. between people and governments and between people and financial institutions, that we aren't harnessing this stuff to a greater degree than everywhere else?
Well, you know, I want to take a step back, though, because, you know, we talk about the consumer and their responsibility and how do we get them, mm-hmm. but it's also about how we get institutions to get out into those communities, right? So we can't lay that solely with the consumer. We need to figure, from an institutional perspective, there's a tension between regulation, knowing your client, knowing your customer, and a population of people who, I would say, by virtue of culture, are not interested in you knowing me and knowing who I am and what I do. And so, you know, culturally, like from my, in my culture, and very similarly in Trinidadian culture and a lot of ethnic cultures, you know, trust of the outside, full stop, is a challenge, right? And so it's not just about the, you know, the banks. It's about anybody who wants to know information about you. Why do you need to know that about me? It's quite a, you know, that's a cultural thing.
Makes people suspicious.
It does. And,
and it's also a generational thing too, right?
Absolutely. But not only is it generational, it's multi-generational because it's passed down through the generations. So, you know, my grandmother would say, why are you telling the bank all that information? Why are you giving them all your birthday and your, you know, your ID number and your, why would you tell them that?
Right.
They're going to do something with it, you know? And so, but that's something that's passed down through generations too, right? Because she only died a month ago. And so, you know, and so she was still talking about those things, you know, to me as a banker who'd been in the banking world for 25 years. She's like, take your money out of that bank. I told you when the global banking crisis happened. But my point in all of this is,
she was one of the few who could have told you,
She was, she said, see, I told you, I kept my money under the mattress. I lost nothing. You know, you fools put your money in those banks and look at you now, rebuilding still. But I think there is, we have to, the kind of corporate social responsibility and going out into communities and ensuring that we do the right thing by the people whose money we keep. And actually, without the consumers, we wouldn't be here, right?
Yeah.
And we forget that, right? It's always about baseline revenue.
I think a lot of people, and maybe it's a, maybe it's just a perception I have, but a lot of people in banking are dealing in really massive deals. They're talking to billionaires. They're moving around such enormous quantities of money in such a cavalier way. It's like, oh, we've got to transfer $1 billion between this bank and this bank. $1 billion.
It's not cavalier.
That is crazy money. Well, it seems like it to
it
us.
It feels like it, I know.
Yeah, maybe TV makes it look that way. Mm-hmm. Maybe the news lets us think that that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it almost feels like, especially after that global banking crisis, well, these guys were, you know, they used the phrase too big to fail. And they were bailed out by governments, by taxpayers. And we were like, why should private businesses and their risky behavior be bailed out by hardworking taxpayers, even if it has to do with a housing, you know, crisis in the housing market and skullduggery by big banks? Most people are like, well, why should we get involved with these guys again? It's fine if the government want to. We can't always control what the idiot politicians decide to do. But why should we have to be a part of this? You know, this
there was a deep sigh, wasn't
there? Yeah. Because I'm sure you guys are like frustrated by this, just like we are.
Well, of course. I mean, we're consumers and we're people too. And I, you know, I'm kind of afraid to say after that statement that you made that I worked at Lehman Brothers at that time. Yeah. At that time.
What was that? We'll get into that in a second.
Yeah,
I'm sure that was a terrible experience.
But it was. But I will say that, you know, it's so challenging because this whole, the issue is that a lot of our economies are built on financial systems. I mean, full stop. And so, like, you know, there are a lot of countries, like the UK, for example, who have very little in the way of export. They export nothing except for financial services. It fails, the UK's economy collapses in a way that would create, you think depression of the 1930s was something, it would have been catastrophic. So the governments had no choice but. And it's partially because, you know, they base their economy on financial services instead of focusing on farming or things that they could export. So they had nothing else. And if the UK fails and falls apart, what happens to the rest of Western Europe? What happens? It's a ripple trickle down effect. There's debt in all of these countries against each other. People start calling debt, which people, you know, most of us don't understand at the base level. But most countries are indebted to other countries for something, and it's mostly financial for a variety of reasons. And so the bailing out the banks wasn't about bailing out the banks. It was about saving our countries and our economies. Full stop. I mean, that was the big deal. And so whilst it appeared that though the banks made the kind of drama happen, the reality is that the saving wasn't of the banks. It was making sure that we could survive and that the world as we know it continued. And that was the thing. Though the banks were obviously at fault for it.
What was it like at Lehman Brothers?
So, you know, I'm glad we're in a fenced-in community because I don't want to have to run when I leave, because I was actually also in the mortgage business. So I was sitting in the mortgage
you
business.
You had a front row seat.
Front row. However, it didn't feel like that at the time, right? So,
were you in that building just off of Times Square?
So I was actually in London. I was in London, which, you know, again, was a really interesting place to be at that time because I was the CIO for the lending businesses, which means that I was responsible for all the technology platform for lending businesses. Yes. I didn't make the choices, but I sat in some rooms and heard some interesting things. And the bank bought a number of subprime lenders across Europe. So my job was integrating them from a technology perspective and operations perspective in. And what we saw was that the mortgage pipeline started to dry up. So we decided in Europe to start winding down our mortgage business before the crisis happened. So we didn't see that coming because that was, it was predominantly the U.S. business. But we didn't, we just were thinking, oh my gosh, we're watching our revenues start to dry up. Because there was a pattern of things that happened well before, you know, it collapsed. That had people understood what it really was, it would have raised alarm bells a lot earlier. Mm-hmm. But nobody understood what it was. We just saw the pipeline drying up of people applying for mortgages, and then it just kind of tumbled out of control. However, I will say that 4 weeks before Lehman crashed, I went to another bank that failed called Royal Bank of Scotland, which almost brought down the UK banking system. So I had some fun during those 2 years.
You must have felt like you were on the run with a fire behind you the whole time.
Seriously.
Wow.
Seriously. Yeah, so I had a great time.
And you stayed in banking. I mean, that's
no, I left. I'm out.
You got out.
No, I didn't. I went to JP Morgan.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
My
yeah.
last job.
You stuck around a little bit after that, and
I did.
And at least JP Morgan is one of the ones that survived. You know,
thank goodness for that.
So it wasn't you. You weren't the curse.
I was not the curse. You know, and I say to people, I left Lehman before it failed, so you should have come with me. You should have watched me. I was, you know, it was
wow.
fun. Yeah.
So when you talk about with that kind of experience, when you talk about leadership and you talk about business and you advise people, I mean, you've got some hard lessons there to share.
Absolutely. Right. And I wouldn't say failed, but I had a pretty sizable consumer goods business myself.
Right.
As an entrepreneur that I went through some real deep.
Well, isn't it true that, and this is something I'm glad you're here for, because Americans, again, I'm generalizing, but you don't consider failure to be a devastating character assassination. What you consider it to be is an experience that you could learn from, right?
Afterwards.
And we, yeah, afterwards, obviously, yeah. Yeah, afterwards, when you're going through yeah. it, it's no fun at all.
No, it is a fail. It is devastating, life-changing
but,
at the time.
But we in South Africa, we consider that if you fail once, well, you must be a failure.
Mm.
And that, I think, can be quite dangerous, because if you don't get up and try again, you might miss the next big thing, and you might not make your contribution.
Right.
And being productive and adding value to an economy is something that really is a skill. It's a talent. It's an ability that not everybody has. And if you start your own business, as small as, you know, a little street vendor,
mm-hmm.
or as big as a multinational corporation, those people are rare. Mm-hmm. They're special people.
Mm-hmm.
And they often are the ones who ask for advice, ask the right questions, mm-hmm. will come to a seminar like this and learn, mm-hmm. even though they've got a lot of the answers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's that desire to learn more that I suppose keeps them on their toes.
Yeah, and when you think of some of the biggest names and the biggest leaders, Oprah, which we mentioned before, they're constantly looking for information. They're constantly reading. They're constantly getting out and asking people for advice, because it really shortens the time in terms of failure for you to get back up on your feet again. But it may help you to avoid failure, because we can learn from each other. And to your point about failure, I'm learning to look at it as that was an experiment. You know, when you think about science projects that you had in the past, you did the experiment to see what worked and what didn't work. Mm-hmm. And so it's just how quickly can you rebound from the last experiment and recap what were the things that I learned about this, and now I know what not to avoid if that situation comes up again. So, you know, that learning piece, though, I think it's getting more and more critical, especially as you see economies grow, having more participation in terms of all of us being global citizens.
Yeah.
Being able to learn from each other is going to become more and more critical as we move along, as well as past failures from other areas that you can use in developing it on the next level.
Couldn't agree more. What is the economy like at the moment? Because we're seeing very healthy numbers. in America. We're seeing great unemployment numbers. We're seeing a lot of things that are very positive. I know that there are people I have regular contact with say that you can. It's easy to get a job now in America.
Depending on who you are, it's easier than it was
10 years ago.
Depends on who you are, your education, your experience.
It's the same. So this is what I was talking about in terms of it being the same. The thing that America's good at is the spin around. No, seriously. I mean, you know, the reality is that if you look at, I think it's, the numbers are pretty staggering. It's something like, I want to say 50% of black children in America live below the poverty line. So everybody's not getting jobs,
yeah.
You know, and the wealthier are getting wealthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a buoyancy in the economy because of the wealth of a few. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the story world round.
Why? Let's ask that question. I mean, why are 50% of black children in America not able to find meaningful employment?
It's not just meaningful employment. It's living below the poverty line. Well, you know, so
that's why is that? What is that about?
It's historical, right? It's the historical oppression of people of color in the United States. You think that there's some race stuff going on here? I mean, in America, mm-hmm. you know, black boys are being shot by police still, and this is 2018.
Yeah, but let's be fair. I mean, the number of black kids shot by police, we can actually quantify. We know those numbers.
We know those numbers, the ones that are reported that make the news.
Well, a death is reported.
A death is reported, but my point is all of them, everything that happens in those interactions don't always make the news. So people get upset about a few. But if you actually look at the numbers, you know, the hundreds of people who are killed by police and gun violence every year in America, it's ridiculous. But what I will say is that it is systemic racism. It's the systems. I don't put that on people all the time. The systems were built. And if we don't address equity in the systems, then you're always going to have this problem. Mm-hmm. The issue is the systems are the fabric, too. And so it's very difficult to unwind those systems.
But how come it's not that those aren't the numbers for Hispanic immigrants? How come those aren't the numbers for...
Hispanic immigrants weren't slaves. Okay, so...
No, I get that. But, you know, at the same time, we've got to look at culture then, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. I mean, we talk about culture when we talk about banking, so we must apply culture here as well. We've
Absolutely.
Got to look at fatherlessness in black communities. Mm-hmm. We've got to look at all these things,
too. You have
that
in Hispanic communities, too.
Yeah, I know, but somehow the Hispanic communities don't show those same levels of poverty in their children, 50%.
Oh, no, there are a lot of Hispanic children that are in poverty, too. I was talking specifically about black children. I don't know the numbers, but they're very, very high. It's children of color, mm-hmm. full stop, in America. It's not just the black community. The issue is that when you have systems of oppression, I mean, you know, 400 years ago is when slavery started in the
Absolutely.
United States.
Absolutely. And we know that that's got a...
And it was 1965.
We know that has an effect.
1963, before there was anything. Black people couldn't vote.
But there's no way racism is higher than it's ever been.
Oh, I mean, it is right now.
I can't imagine that Martin 100%. Luther King would agree with that.
Oh,
I'm
absolutely.
Sure,
No.
People who couldn't sit on the back of the bus, like
no,
Rosa
they will
Parks,
say,
would say... It can't be as bad now.
My mother, who is 70 years old, says that it is worse than she has ever, even as a child, for her. The way that it feels in America right now for black people feels worse than she felt as a child in America.
So then the civil rights movement achieved nothing.
We're detracting.
I mean,
that.
We can't say that, right?
No, we're not saying it
that
means
something. That would be a terrible admission.
Obviously, it means something. Obviously, we can vote. Obviously, we can move around. Obviously, we can do things that we couldn't do. The issue is, when you keep people oppressed economically, nothing changes, you know, and at the moment, given kind of what's happening, and I'm not going to blame it solely on Trump, because there are a whole bunch of people who agree with him and who follow what he does and says, right, and who thinks it's great. What he's allowed, though, is for people to say what they really think and that they couldn't before, they felt like they couldn't before, right? And
so he's allowed people to be... Honestly racist.
Honestly racist, mm-hmm. and honestly misogynist.
But isn't that better than being deceitfully racist and deceitfully misogynist,
no.
where you hide it and pretend everything's all right? That's that spin you were talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, because I think there's a difference between... There's a difference.
I mean, we deal with this all the time in South
of course.
Africa, right?
Of
Which
course
is why
do.
We it's front and center in our society and our politics every day.
Of course.
But the numbers, whether there's spin involved there or not, would show that unemployment is at a better rate than it's ever been. Isn't it?
It's better, but it doesn't feel better for anybody, and that's the issue.
Well, your feelings are irrelevant.
No, our feelings are very relevant.
No, they're not relevant.
As a black person in America, it's very relevant.
You're bankers. Your feelings don't matter in banking.
I'm not a banker.
It's your background. It's your background. If you come to the bank, if you go to the board meeting and say, my feelings are X... In the board meeting.
Maybe they should. Maybe if they did
then it wouldn't be a very good bank, would it?
No, that's not the case, because the human piece of this is very important. It's the part that's missing. The human piece and taking account of people is the issue.
Maybe
in
HR.
No, not in HR.
It's not important in finance.
It absolutely is important in finance, because without your people and without the people who make it happen, it's not going to happen. It can't happen.
Look, I'm just saying reported statistics can't be... You can't argue about them. These are government. They're not trying to...
I want to add in a couple of things. First, we got to remember that the unemployment rate is based on people who are reporting that they're unemployed and they're collecting unemployment insurance.
Absolutely.
So as you stop engaging in that process, there are a whole lot of people that are still unemployed. It's just not rolling up into the numbers. In terms of our civil rights gains, we're starting to see that be eroded because of voter suppression. We've had gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering of the districts.
So there are challenges that are...
By no means am I saying that what's going on right now is great.
I just want to give some perspective for individuals who feel like it just should be... You guys should still be fine. Yeah. It looks good, but there are things that we need to make sure that we understand that are behind the numbers. Okay. And so when we think about education, the quality of education, so that our kids can be a part of the new community in terms of technology, we do have available jobs. People do have work at high salaries that they can access if you have the education and training to take it. Absolutely. So a lot of people are still looking for manufacturing jobs. They're still looking for basic blue-collar work, and that's the part that's creating challenges in the economy and creating more of this tale of two worlds where you have the extreme wealth and then you still have a lack of access to...
Maybe I should have explained the context we have, because this is why this is important to me. Because we're dealing with 27.5% unemployment in South Africa, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Youth unemployment is over 50%.
Mm-hmm.
That means young people in this country, the prospects of finding a job are nil.
Mm. Right.
And many of those people aren't just unemployed, they're unemployable. Because our education, if you talk about bad education systems, I mean, it's been flawed.
Right.
Thank God someone like Oprah comes in and launches the Leadership Academy for Girls, because otherwise, for a lot of these very talented, very capable young women, there would not be a way for them to improve their or their family's lives.
Exactly.
So this is the context in South Africa.
Get it.
And when we look at, and I had the privilege of going to hear your former president speak on Tuesday, and he said some very, very relevant things, and he gave a very good trajectory of how, if you take things back to when Madiba was born in 1918, and you look at where we are now, we mustn't imagine the world is worse, because in every way it's better for everyone.
Mm.
The very rich, of course, are much, much richer than they would have been then. There's been some fallout.
Mm-hmm.
The very poor in those days, I read a statistic the other day that every minute, something like 40 Indian people are pulled out of poverty.
Mm.
Every minute, 40 people. The world is improving in exponential ways, and we get fixated on Trump, or we get fixated on Theresa May's Brexit, or we get fixated on all this stuff, and actually, to the ordinary people on the ground, it makes very little difference unless their lives are improving or they're declining.
That's true.
Mm.
So that's kind of the context that I brought this up in.
But what it does is it creates an environment and an emotion, and we do have to make sure that we acknowledge how you feel.
Right.
That impacts my pride in my country in some cases, how I feel in terms of hopefulness. We do look at, from an economic perspective, how people are feeling. Do they feel positive about where the economy is going? We do measure that. And so feelings and emotions do drive into this.
They drive elections.
Half the reason we ended up with Trump is because people didn't believe in the
economy.
They
feel like they were part of it.
Part of that and their feelings, right?
Yeah.
They felt left behind and felt disenfranchised.
And that's why I'm saying feelings are so dangerous, because feelings have brought us Trump.
But people are always going to have feelings, right? So we have to figure out how they are, though, right?
I mean, look, I can tell you now, there are a lot of South Africans who are not particularly proud of being South African.
Mm.
There are a lot of South Africans who are not particularly enthusiastic about being South African.
Mm-hmm.
We have whether people have the ability or not to leave. Mm-hmm. Many very, very talented black and white people in this country are getting the hell out because taxes are on the way up, because opportunities on the way down, because we have this unemployment crisis. We've got massive corruption to deal with. And it's not going to work itself out if those people disappear.
Right.
And to keep them here is hard.
It's very hard.
What do they want to stay here for? They could go and set up shop like, you know, you said Trinidad and Tobago for your ancestors. My mother's mother was from Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to stay there either. Right. They wanted to get out because they wanted to find a place they could do things.
Right. That's true.
So I'm just trying to compare the two so that we in South Africa can get an idea, an impression of what's happening there.
I think the interesting thing is, and I kind of started with this early on, is that it ain't the best everywhere. I mean, like, everybody has massive issues right now. And it's kind of it's something that's happening in the world. It's not a South Africa problem. And so, you know, it was really interesting because we talked about the kind of South African brain drain on Monday at the business summit. And there was like the tale of two worlds. Some people were like, yes, there's this massive brain drain. And others were like, please go out into the world and make your mark as a South African externally and help us build brand South Africa. So I think it's a very different, it depends on where you sit, what your opinion is around that. But I will say that, you know, America, you know, I love my country and I wouldn't say that I didn't. But I've spent the last 25 years outside of it, almost. I mean, I went back a year and a half ago after having been gone for several years. It's my perspective is so different because I had that experience. And coming back to America, you know, it is a bit of it's a mess. You know, it is a mess. And you go into certain communities and the issue is, right, so all the kind of governmental things that are happening right now are things that are being put in place and things that are being rolled back, which take us back. Mm-hmm. They don't move us forward, right? They're not future looking. And that's the thing that's concerning because whilst right now you may see a really healthy economy, in 10 years when the population of youth is much higher and we've put these things in place which make it much more difficult for them to access the economy, because that's essentially what some of the policy decisions that's what the effect of the policy decisions that are happening 10 years from now.
Are we talking about any particular policies?
I mean, there is, let me think about so let's look at, for example, right, immigration, right? We talk about how we're doing this thing where we're kind of trying to keep everybody out of America. I mean, it's like the build that wall, right? When you talk about our farming industry and the people who are doing the work physically,
it's not Americans.
Mm-hmm. Right, we rely on that population, you know, on the population from South Mexico and South America the 70th percentile, and you're telling people to stay out, and, you know, people are feeling unwelcome and they're leaving. What does that mean for farming 5, 7, 10 years from now? So, you know, it's those are the
might kind. Be machines.
It might be machine, maybe. I mean, maybe machines, but, you know, we have to, there is a tipping point, which we are not at, and that makes the assumption that all of the farms across America can afford the automation, which is not the case, that would allow machines to take over.
Mm-hmm. And frankly, farming's already subsidized in much of the United States.
Hugely.
Which, to me, sounds like protectionism, which I don't like the idea of. I'm a free trade kind of guy.
I am
the
too.
The less government there is, the better, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, right? Mm-hmm. And then look at, I mean, talk about trade wars with China, like, you know, imposing tariffs on these massive economies who you import huge numbers from. You know, so those policies right now, it feels good. But wait for 5 or 7 years. And the problem is that a lot of this is being passed into law quietly. There's the distraction of all the drama and crazy and fanfare
and
reality TV show stuff that's
Stormy
happening
Daniels.
Every day, right? But then, if you look at the actual the quiet policy things that are happening behind the scenes, that's the issue.
Yep.
That's what I'm so passionate about. That's why I'm kind of like, listen, we have to, and this is how it feels, because it's not actually just about how it feels, but if you add the disenfranchised feeling with the policies that are now being implemented, we're in trouble 5 to 7 years from now.
And I want to see our systems work. So the challenge for me is we were we were really sold on this democracy and having a balance, that there's checks and balances to make sure that we're, that everybody's doing what they're supposed to do.
Well, and your Supreme Court, you got your Congress at the moment, and your White House not looking very balanced.
Not at all. And so that's where you before you had some level of confidence, right? Going back to that emotion, confidence that, okay, if this person over here is not doing what they're supposed to do, at least you have Congress, at least you have the Supreme Court to make sure that there's some kind of balance. That's not happening. And so what I can say that I think is positive about South Africa is, at least where you've had corruption, there's starting to be that accountability, right?
Well, and I'm holding
thumb. Least we're saying it. At least we're saying it. Right. We're not necessarily saying
that.
We won't say it because we know it's not going to happen. So I think there are things we can learn about at least having people, you know, show up for court, you know, answer to your crimes. Make sure you're paying your own legal fees. I mean, to be able to do that, I think that level takes baby steps. But that level of accountability at least will make me think twice before I just come, you know, rob you out of your account. You know, because I know that there are consequences. And so that's the challenge right now, at least how I'm feeling, is this, we're supposed to have this quote-unquote balance. And even though there may be some level of cynicism because of what we've seen in the past where the government may not have shown up for certain groups, I think more people should be feeling that. Because most folks are not, they're not concerned because the hole's not on their side of the boat yet.
Yeah.
Right. When that water starts rising on your side,
you know, everybody's, then people start feeling everybody's it. Also saying the U.S. economy is it's been on this, you know, sort of bull market for such a long time now. And people are worried that when that stops, everybody's going to lose confidence and the whole economy will start contracting. Yeah. I mean, that's something to think about. I'm interested, though, in some other stuff about you. India, I found out that you speak fluent French, functional Japanese.
Oui, je parle français.
Wow.
Oui, oui.
You live between London and D.C.
I do.
And you've got three kids.
I do.
That is a busy life.
It's a crazy
life. How do you fit this stuff in that you're doing here in South Africa?
So I spend... So my husband still lives in London. Okay. I live in D.C.
Right.
I went about a year and a half ago. We're transitioning. He's coming, so he says. But he doesn't want to leave our son, who's in university in England at Nottingham. He's at my son's at the University of Nottingham, Brad, and he didn't want to leave him. And then my daughters, Maya and Tia, are with me in D.C. So we do a lot of backwards and forwards because my girls are daddy's girls. And then they've never forgiven me yet for the fact their daddy is in London. So there's a part
this
of
this is a real modern family.
This is a real modern family. But I think for me, and I think... You know, in terms of, you talked about me being here and how do I find the time to be here. The whole of the continent for me represents great promise. And being a person of the diaspora, I think what I see hope on the continent and that I don't see in other places, frankly. Mm-hmm. I see opportunity on the continent that I don't see in other places. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as governments are becoming more stable, we're talking about the AU and a whole bunch of other things happening. I want to be a part of my community here. And I think that, you know, we talk about brain drain. There are a lot of us across the diaspora who haven't felt necessarily welcome to come back to the continent in the same way, because what people say to us is you're not really African or you don't have. And actually,
I mean, just in terms of documents, we could make it easier for people to come and visit, but it's hard.
Well,
right.
It's not. No, I don't know that it's that. I think that it's, again, the sentiment. Right. It's as African-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans and even, you know, Afro-Caribbeans in the UK or, you know, of African descent in the UK, we've always felt that we weren't welcome in the same way because African people will from born of the continent will tell you you're not really African. Mm-hmm. And that was not by choice. You know, we were kind of taken. Yeah. We were not necessarily, we didn't leave by choice and say, hey, let us come back. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we all want to come back. What I'm saying is the diaspora is really powerful.
But if you did want, and I appreciate that there are so many people, I think it would be great for our country if we could attract, and not just our country, but the rest of Africa, if we could attract some of that real talent back here to help grow this continent and our economy.
I mean, and that's why I'm here.
But we're making it hard because if you wanted to work here, for example, that's a whole mission and a half.
Yeah, it is.
And that's
yeah.
just paperwork. That's the bureaucracy. Yeah. We could figure that out.
Yeah, but I think that I think there's some work that we have to do around how we attract people and how we bring them back. So this bringing this delegation here for me was about, you know, showing people the opportunity here, which I think if there's a push and the pull, I think that it's easier. But right now, there's really no push to come. You know, so it's how do we create that and how do we kind of
What kind of people did you meet while you were at the conference and in the last few days, and what kinds of stories have you heard?
Can we talk about our dinner starting Sunday night?
Sure.
So our opening dinner, which was tremendous, was at the home of Maki Mandela.
Okay.
She invited us all for dinner. So the delegation of our six African-American women, and she and her daughter, Tequini, had a wonderful opening dinner. And to hear about the vision of Madiba from his first daughter mm-hmm. was kind of set us off mm-hmm. on a mission, didn't it?
Yeah.
So that was our first day, and then we had the summit, and mm-hmm. we met some wonderful people at the summit. Obviously, I talked about Colin Coleman and Kuseni Dlamini and Dr. Petrus Koch from Brown South Africa, and Peter Crawley from Citi and Sneha Shah from Thomson Reuters. So there were a lot of kind of banking people there, but also Faith Kanyile.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some really great minds in the room. Mm-hmm. And what that did for the delegation that I brought was show them that actually the talent is no different here.
Yeah.
It's a smaller place, mm-hmm. but the talent is no different. And we should be engaging as business leaders. My view of the world is right now things are crazy, right? I mean, crazy everywhere. And as business leaders and individuals, it's incumbent upon us to build those relationships and go back and influence where we sit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what that summit was about. And then we went to the lecture series.
That was just phenomenal. And I love Barack because he was so shady. just in addressing issues and the way in which he does it, you know, talking about the lying and, you know,
yeah.
the corruption. But he also gave a tremendous amount of hope, right, for the future and held us accountable to making sure that we're part of the solution and not just sitting back and withdrawing because you feel as though things, you know, are going to hell in a handbasket. So I was just so pleased, even though I was cold. You know, my heart was warmed by being
cold?
Able to see
they didn't
there.
Give you a blanket?
Yeah, but that blanket wasn't enough. I needed, you know, fur, goose down, something. But, you know, it was a great, great day.
That, but I think also for us, right, being able to see, we were lucky to be sitting on the field.
Right on
so we
field.
Were, like, yeah. right on field. So, like, seeing Cyril Ramaphosa up close.
Yes.
And Mama Grasha up close.
Yeah.
And, you know, Patrice Motsepe. And just seeing, like, some of the leaders of South Africa mm-hmm. sitting on that stage with Barack Obama was a lot. And then the Soweto Gospel Choir. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
They start singing. We're all singing. I'm falling on the floor crying.
It's the best choir in the world.
What? I mean it. Seriously.
Best choir in the world.
And that young lady.
The most beautiful national anthem in the world. Yeah. I mean, honestly.
Glad you think so. Yeah, we sometimes get a little hard on ourselves about that.
The most seriously, we were like, tissues, please,
yeah.
tissues. We couldn't hold it.
And that young lady that hosted, she did a phenomenal job. She's going to be somebody we need to watch.
So, mm-hmm. Camille, yeah. you, I didn't realize you actually have qualifications in laboratory science?
I do.
Wow.
Yes.
Another... You're like a polymath as well. You know, all this stuff going on.
Yes. I'm intellectually curious. And
good.
My background's in STEM. I was going to go to medical school and got almost to the end of my degree and decided this isn't for me. I still worked in the field, still became board certified, and then used that to put myself through graduate school. So it gave me perspective on the healthcare industry. And funnily enough, during my run in Global Commercial Bank, where I am now, I did work for part of our not-for-profit and healthcare practice.
Okay.
So you're able to still make the connection on the other side on how we support large healthcare organizations. But yes, I do have a science background.
Well, I can only say thank you for coming to spend some time with us this morning. I was very excited to meet you today, and I was very, very pleased to hear about what's been going on, these conversations that have been had, that people are starting to talk to each other about mm-hmm. how we can cooperate better internationally. You know, these phones and everything else have made it so easy for us to do business now.
It does.
It's way better and easier than it's ever been mm-hmm. to communicate across continents. And, you know, for all we know, one day we'll all be part of one big global community anyway, and there won't be all this complication and red tape. I hope so, too.
Yes.
I think it would be great. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And keep pushing. I love the debate. It's amazing.
Well, you're fabulous.
Great host.
Imagine if we just sat and everybody was all in agreement the whole time.
That's not fun.
No.
Very boring.
That's not fun.
Not at all.
Very boring.
We love it. Yeah. Thank you, Sia.
Love
too.
Talking to you guys. And enjoy the Oprah Leadership Academy today.
Oh, we're delighted.
I hope that goes well.
We shall.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. All right. There we are, everybody. That's a wrap on the morning from us, India Martin and Camille John Jenkins, who came to spend some time with us today. 9:13. We will catch you on the flip side tomorrow morning, 6:00.
This is CliffCentral.com.